I'm just gonna call this meeting to order right now. It is 5:31 on Tuesday, February 20th. Calling to order the Planning Commission meeting. Starting on my far left, if we could have introductions for the record.
Jim Swenson, South Kitsap.
Aaron Murphy, North Kitsap.
Tom Nevins, North Kitsap.
Joe Phillips, Central.
Care Ann Gonzalez Harless, South Kitsap.
Robert Baglio, South Kitsap.
And Gina Buskirk from Central Kitsap. Do we have a motion for adoption of the agenda tonight?
I'll move adoption of the agenda.
I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? All in favor of adopting the agenda? Oh, okay, I've got to finish. As presented. Thank you, Aaron. I'll approve. Everybody? Okay. I think we had everybody that was unanimous. Everybody present. And minutes. Did anybody have a chance to review the minutes from our last meeting? Seeing some heads nodding yes. Do we have a motion for approval of the minutes?
Move to approve the minutes.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor of approving the minutes? That was unanimous for all members present. Carries. All right. On to findings of fact and Liz Williams. Is that a presentation? I'm sorry, I'm still looking at the minutes. All right, so we're going to get case law updates from Lisa Nickel.
Yeah, if you guys want to come out into the audience so you can view the presentation, we've just got the one screen working right now.
Oh, I wasn't aware that there was only one screen. I can send them to you, but I don't have them. No. This is going to be weird, so bear with me. I'll stand over here. Can you hear me okay with this? So as some of you may know, I'm Lisa Nickel. I'm over the prosecutor's office. I've been with the county for almost 15 years, and I took over Shelley Knight's body of work when she retired in October. So I'm giving the GMA presentation that she has usually given. I understand that you haven't given, kind of go through the history, hasn't given a case law update since 2013, but I understand she gave kind of a base GMA basics in 2014 and 2017. So hopefully you guys have covered all that. So I'll assume you kind of know a little bit about that and won't go into the details. But if you have questions, then feel free to ask them at any point or even later. We do have a couple pending appeals with the 2016 comp plan, and so I won't be going into any of those details. It's still in litigation. And since we do have quite a time frame between the last case law update and now, a little under 5 years, I went through mostly the court cases as opposed to the Growth Management Hearings Board cases. Those are a lot of fact-specific ones. And so the case law with the courts tend to establish a little bit more broad rules that we should follow. So I grouped them into areas that they focused on. There's about five of them doing rezones. Three of them addressed a lot of the jurisdictional issues between what goes to the growth board and what goes to the court, but those also had some more details in them. And then two of them, the last two, got into some of the details of the rezones. So Kittitas County versus Kittitas County Conservation District is Eastern Washington. I don't know if everyone's been through I-90. There's this big Thorpe antique mall, a lot of cool stuff. The developer wanted to expand that to 29 acres of additional development with fuel station, retail store, two retail stores for about 15,000 square feet, a restaurant, 50-unit hotel, and a 45-space RV park. They wanted to operate 24 hours a day and have 140 people employed, and they estimated they would generate about $1.9 million in revenue. Excuse me, my voice. So the county thought this was a great thing for the economy, and they executed two comp plan amendments and one zoning amendment. The comp plan amendments, they wanted to expand their LAMR, the Limited Area of More Intensive Rural Development, which was a type 3, almost double, 12, or just over double, 12 acres to 30 acres. And then they wanted to change the comp plan designation of there from rural to commercial and the zoning from agricultural to commercial highway. FutureWise appealed this rezone, and one of the jurisdictional issue was that site-specific, so it should go to the Superior Court in the county. That's what the county claimed, was that the Growth Board didn't have jurisdiction. And because this also had a comp plan amendment associated with it, and because it was required to change the comp plan in order to do the zoning, it was properly before the Growth Board. So if it was just straight site-specific with no associated comp plan, it would have gone to Superior Court. With regard to the LAMRD, Type 3 LAMRD is pretty unique. We've got a couple of them in the county here. And they allow intensification of development on lots containing isolated non-residential uses or development of isolated cottage industries and isolated small-scale businesses. And with what was being proposed here, it definitely wasn't small-scale. And the court went through the facts and said it doesn't fit this Type 3 LAMRD. You shouldn't have this area being expanded into a LAMRD. So they reversed all of that, and the project didn't go forward. Next one is also in Eastern Washington, where there was an existing use on property just outside of a LAMRD. It had a market, a produce store, and a bistro, and the developer wanted to expand that to have an expanded restaurant, outdoor seating, additional parking, a drive-through coffee stand. And this one needed a comp plan amendment as well as a rezone. And in this, the court said, just like we discussed a month ago in Kittitas County, because there was a comp plan amendment that needed to be done in order to execute this rezone, it was properly before the Growth Board. As far as the LAMRD, this one was a type 1 LAMRD, which we also have. And they said that because, well, the rezone of property just outside the LAMRD was to zoning that was within the LAMRD. They had site-specific zoning for the LAMRD of a limited development area, and that was the zoning within the LAMRD. And they put that zoning on property right next to the LAMRD outside these boundaries that it had established in 1993. And the court said, by doing that, you're expanding the boundaries of the LAMRD. And one of the requirements of the Type 1 LAMRD under case law is that you're kind of hemmed in by this logical outer boundary. And so by doing that, you're expanding it, and you didn't minimize and contain the logical outer boundary. Also with this comp plan, the court found, or the Spokane County's comprehensive plan required that in order to do this expansion, you needed to have a public necessity finding, and the county didn't do any finding like that. And the county before the court argued, it's just a comp plan, it's guidance, we don't need to have this finding. And the court said it's written as a finding requirement, you need to have this requirement. Court also said that community desire for the project isn't the public necessity. It's not a need, it's a want. So that didn't qualify either. One more. Based on the public necessity, I think that aspect you could show it's a need because it's you need sewer for a project or for environmental health protection, whatever the issue is. I'm not so sure about the extension of the outer boundary. I one on the docket that's kind of going to this issue. And that's more of a question because we're expanding with not adding a whole new parcel. So it's kind of a gray area there. The other issue in this case was SEPA that was done. And the court found, both the growth board and the court found that the checklist didn't actually identify the long-term impacts of this project. They had said, well, we'll do an environmental review at the project level. And the court said that's not good enough. You know this is a non-conforming use. It's existing. You know the impacts now. And also when you're rezoning, you're allowing a whole bunch of new types of uses. And so that needs to be redone at the planning level. So this next case is also a growth board or site-specific zoning issue, but it puts a little twist on it. Because this one, the property owner didn't request the rezone. He had requested a rezone earlier from commercial to industrial when he bought the property and the city annexed it. But then later the city decided that, this was part of their gateway area. They wanted it to look nice. They wanted to put a bunch of design regulations on there. And so they put this overlay zone for gateway to make it look nice. And the property owner said, that's all fine and good with the design standards, but it's so onerous that you're actually preventing me from doing my industrial use that I got permitted for, or not permitted, the prior zoning change. And so the property owner, because he thought it was site-specific to that parcel, challenged it in court because there was no need for a comp plan designation change with that. And the court said, well, actually, in this one, under LUPA, to go to Superior Court, you need to have an application for a project permit. And when a government is proposing the rezone, there's no application. It's not project. So now the cases hold that growth board gets rezones if there's also a comp plan amendment that needs to be done. And also, if there is not an application by the county, because it's doing its legislative duties in adopting the rezone. So it's not project-specific. So our last two rezone cases are more fact-specific, and I kept this one in even though it's pretty detailed because it has to do with compatible uses near central public facilities such as the base and the Spokane International Airport, and we have that. We have bases in here. And one thing to understand with this case is that in 2004, GMA was amended to make it a priority to not have incompatible uses around the bases or other military installations that make it incompatible or make it affect the installation's ability to carry out its missions. GMA also has a regulation that prohibits counties from in the comp plan or development regulation from including the siting or expansion of these essential public facilities. And then the Planning Enabling Act, which was adopted pre-GMA, and some of the partial planning counties still use that to plan. They said that comp plans shall not discourage the siting of the essential public facilities. So under these, you can't have incompatible uses around military installations or essential public facilities like airports. And you can't do anything to discourage or prevent them from siting or expanding. And the growth board, in this case, said that the rezone from commercial to multifamily residential adjacent to these areas was incompatible. And there's a lot of facts to go into that. One of the most important ones was this joint land use study, which Kitsap County has. And in their joint land use study, they said this type of development is incompatible. That's just black and white in there. They had significant noise issues, and that the area of the runway, there's impacts after that. There's certain circles from the airport that there's more crashes or accidents in the high air traffic patterns. And also in this case, there was a help to the court in that the county had mistakenly approved a large subdivision next to the Spokane Airport, and so it was already being developed, and they were hearing a lot of complaints, and so that was in the record as well. The court court upheld the incompatibility, but then also said that just because it's incompatible doesn't mean that it necessarily precludes or discourages the expansion of these areas. So the court reversed the growth board on those issues. So we need to be careful to have compatible uses, but even those, if it's compatible, it's not necessarily discouraging or preventing. In this case, they didn't have facts to suggest that it was doing that. The last rezone case we have is where the county approved a site-specific amendment to their comp plan to allow a multifamily project in an area that seemed good for this. It had a mall on one side and a large multifamily housing development on the other, but there was a lot of traffic impact associated with that because the mall couldn't let them use access through there. DOT wouldn't allow them to use access through another road. So they were limited to this pretty narrow, no sidewalk, undeveloped road. And the county said, well, we'll address the traffic impact through the project application. Neighbors sued to the growth board saying this kind of deferral and analyzing it later was improper. The growth board said, yes, you need to do this type of level of analysis at the planning stage, but the court reversed, fortunately, because what the growth board was wanting was a review of our capital facilities element, capital facilities planning, and concurrency ordinance type of review, even at the planning stage. And the court said, no, GMA doesn't require this level of review at this stage because GMA has specific timelines for the capital facilities element review and capital facilities planning. It's every 8 years for the elements, we have a transportation improvement, the TIP that schedules the projects and the funding, that's every 6 years. We have concurrency ordinances that said if a project comes in and it reduces the level of service, then we can prohibit the development. And that's in GMA. So all of those taken together says that GMA doesn't require this level of review when you're doing comp plan amendments. And then finally, they threw in that the local project review, which is where we go under LUPA at a Superior Court when we have projects, that said if that statute requires project level review for traffic impacts and other things. And so the court said if GMA also required that, it would be inconsistent with that other statute. So that's it for the rezones. There's four kind of resource lands. And I can go through the ag ones pretty quickly because we don't have any agricultural lands of long-term significance here. But just to give you a background on this, on FutureWise versus Growth Management Hearings Board, FutureWise challenged Pacific County's update to its comp plan because of its ag criteria. They thought it didn't comply with GMA, and then they didn't use that new criteria to update their ag lands. And the court, in reviewing the records, said all the county did was update its criteria based on the Washington Administrative Codes, which were in effect. So there was no actual change to their criteria, and so they didn't actually need to change their designations either. The next one goes up to Whatcom County, where the gravel mine operator requested that the county designate about 200 acres of land mineral resource land so they can continue mining on that. In this case, the staff recommended approval because it met all criteria. The Planning Commission recommended approval because it complied with all criteria in their comp plan. But the council rejected it and didn't approve the designation. And under the facts of the case, it says that the people on the council that rejected the designation didn't talk about whether or not it complied with the criteria, but that there was a lot of environmental impacts with the mining that they were concerned about. The growth board upheld the county's decision not to designate, and the court did as well. What they said was, even though the comp plan has policies saying, okay, here's what you need to do in order to designate this land, neither the comp plan nor GMA actually requires that if these things are met, that you have to designate. So it's really discretionary for the county when you're designating land that somebody's requested you to do that. Under Section 130, the review and revise section, the court said This just means you have to consider. You don't actually have to take action when somebody requests a designation. And one other thing in this case was that under the Whatcom County's comp plan, it said that you may only designate if it's in within the public interest of doing so. And so that's a balancing factor, and that gets you, even though it might have met all the criteria, there's this other portion that you need to balance the best interest of the county. And the county felt that it didn't comply with that public interest. This next one, kind of odd facts, but it's interesting, so I'll go through it quickly. Skamania County is one of those partial planning counties, so all they have to do is designate critical areas and natural resource lands. They don't have to do GMA planning. That's under the Planning Enabling Act, which, by the way, any appeals under there go straight to Superior Court. They don't go to the Growth Board. So the county completed their natural resource designations in 2005, but they acknowledged they didn't do their critical area designations, so that's a separate issue. In 2007, the county adopted a new comp plan, but then also put a moratorium on all building on these unmapped lands. And that's something that these Planning Enabling Act jurisdictions, it's kind of, we recognize there's areas that can have, we don't know what to zone them, so they're kind of a free-for-all, the court said. So you can have those, and the county said, well, we have them, but we want to put them temporary while we figure out where these critical areas are, and then we'll designate. So even though that was adopted in 2007, this moratorium meant that it wasn't effective until they made changes in 2012. In 2012, they left some areas unmapped, they designated the critical areas, and then the Save Our Scenic Area challenged their comp plan, and the county argued that their challenge to the natural resource designations was untimely, and also the challenge to the zoning was untimely. The Superior Court agreed, but then the Court of Appeals reversed, saying that regarding the natural resource lands, they were designated in 2005, but the resolution that designated them didn't actually reference GMA as far as their review and revise requirements. And so it was just, they did it on its own, and they still had the review and revise requirements, which at the time was only 3 months later, but then the legislature extends those, so they had a 2008 review and revise, and no action was taken on that. They had their designations from 2005, and the court said that because no review and revise was actually done, this was a failure to act challenge, and those can be brought any time. So there was no timeliness issue. On the zoning, the court said that because this unmapped areas were temporary because of the moratorium. Those were taken off in 2012. So even though it looked like they were designated in 2007, they weren't effective in 2012. And so when the Save Our Scenic Area challenged, it was timely. So our last resource land one is back over in Fannery County. They have a lot of critical area and eggland designation issues over the years. So this particular case started in 2001 when they first designated egglands of long-term significance, and they had been remanded back and appealed many times until 2013 when the Growth Board finally said, okay, set your eggland designation. It's based on a point system. You get points for the soil class, ownership size, availability of public services, distance from urban areas and egg markets. And so based on those point systems, they designated a whole bunch of land. Concerned Friends of Superior County challenged the point system kind of classification and also the amount of land they designated. And the court said the designation criteria were good. They actually matched the WACs for what they needed to consider. But they actually didn't designate. Their actual designation was noncompliant. And the court took a chart that they had in their comp plan that kind of listed out how many egg lands they had designated over the years. and they looked at the bottom number and interpreted it differently than the county and the Superior Court had. They had said that this 2,816 acres should have been designated, whereas the county said these were excluded areas. So the court essentially took over that analysis and didn't really explain well, other than this is how we interpret the chart. But I think more significantly, the designations were found non-compliant because 99% of the 500,000 acres of ag land they designated, most of it was federal grazing land and state grazing land, which the county had no jurisdiction over, so they could be changed at any time. And then only 405 acres were privately held lands, but these had conservation easements on them, so they were kind of set for ag purposes on a separate issue. So the county really didn't do any good designations that would help their agriculture economy. So they had to go back and do more action on that. There's about three critical area and one shoreline cases. These are kind of fact specific, so I won't get into the details because, as you might know, when you designate designate critical areas and protect them, you need to comply with best available science, and all of that's kind of in the record. And so it's hard to take somebody else's best available science record and say, okay, we need that. But there are kind of a level of legal interpretations here that are important to kind of go through. Again, in Ferry County, they have, I don't know if people have been following, probably since the beginning of GMA, they haven't had a good CAO or a compliant CAO. In this case, it still has problems. They decided to finally reference the Fish and Wildlife Priority Species list, but then they said there's none here, so we don't have to protect them locally. And then they didn't designate any habitat for those species. So that was a big error that they had. And again, Ferry County used their own scientists who said, well, there's none of these species in the area, but none of this was documented in the record or really scientific with peer review analysis and all of that typical BAS, best available science information. So the legal holdings that are relevant is when you include best available science in setting your critical areas, you actually need to have an explanation as to what is reviewed and considered. You don't need to have a separate kind of best available science document, but it needs to be in the record. It's okay to disagree with state agency analysis of what's a priority species or what kind of what you need to do to set buffers or whatever, but you need to have your own valid scientific information when you're setting something. It's okay to depart from best available science, but it has to be done through a sufficiently reasoned process. There were some earlier cases that said this reasoned process has to itself be scientific, and some of the later cases now have said it doesn't have to be, but it still has to be reasoned. And it almost is like the court will say, I'll know it when I see it. It doesn't give you a good guideline of what's the reasoned process. And then finally, you can't point to lack of science for failing to protect something. If there isn't a science document you can show to say, okay, this is a good buffer or good protection, the WAC says you have to take a no-risk approach. Oh, sorry, forgot to advance. Closer to home, Clallam County had some challenges for their CAO, and this one doesn't really help us too much because we didn't opt into the voluntary stewardship program, which is an alternative way to protect critical areas and ag lands together. In this one, Clallam County had a lot of issues and went back to the growth board many times on having a finding non-compliance and protecting their critical areas. And while they were in a remand, the legislature adopted a moratorium in 2007 saying you can't change your CAOs anymore, we're going just with this, and that was while they were adopting the voluntary stewardship program, which was done in 2011. When Clallam County went back to the growth board, they said, well, under this voluntary stewardship program, the legislature said you can protect critical areas adequately if you have one of these four jurisdictions, you know, match their CAO, and that was one of them was Claremont County. And so it was odd for the county because the legislature said, okay, if you use this alternative program, Claremont County has a valid CAO. But the court found that Claremont County didn't opt in to this alternative program, so they couldn't use their own CAO to prove validity with GMA. What they should have done was just opt in, and then they could have been fine. But under this case, they didn't. So the last specific CAO challenge was up in San Juan County, and there's not a lot of factual pieces to this, but there's a lot of legal holdings. And one of these apply because we always get these challenges on our CAOs. Not this time, yes, and not next time. But. Now, this case is unpublished, but it's interesting. There's another case later on that has the same holding. But a lot of the property rights groups challenge our CAOs, or they didn't challenge our SMP, but they do based on takings analysis. You set these buffers, you're taking my property. Well, this court held that the Nolan-Dolan analysis, which requires you to have nexus and proportionality between any impacts of development, they said doesn't apply in a facial challenge to a comp plan or a development regulation. You can apply those when you have a project permit, and those project permits get appealed. But when you're just challenging a whole ordinance, that level of review doesn't apply. What does apply is the 82020, which essentially incorporates the nexus and proportionality requirements. So it's the same thing, but the people who appeal have to figure out which one they're going to argue under the common law, case law-driven Nolan-Dolan analysis or the statutory analysis. This case also had challenged, Common Sense Alliance said that you can't have performance standards to figure out your critical areas. You need to have them mapped. And the court said, no, you don't have to do mapping. These performance standards of saying, okay, this is what a critical area is. When you find this, this is a critical area, and it needs to be mapped or figured out in the project. San Juan had a small exemption for wetlands, and they said that was fine because it was very specific and restricted to limit the actual exception, and ecology approved, essentially. They agreed in the comment letters. They didn't say this is not appropriate. They said, well, if you use this language, it should be good. So I think that went a long way in convincing the court that it was GMA compliant. San Juan County also had buffer reductions in their ordinance to protect views and protect tree zones and gardens. And the court said that these were fine because their impacts were mitigated. And specifically with gardens, I noticed this was, and they spent a little bit more time on that, but because it's San Juan County and an island, they said that the gardens are necessary for growing the vegetables and other things that you can't get as easily. So it was an interesting analysis. This last one is a very lengthy case, so I'll try to summarize quickly. This is over Jefferson County's SMP update, which so this is the last case, or the most recent case in all of this, where Olympic Stewardship Foundation, Citizens Alliance for Property Rights, and Hood Canal Sand and Gravel Challenge. So it was all more developer property rights groups, and so that's the focus on a lot of these issues. And under the Shoreline Management Act, the court said that the goal of property rights is actually secondary to protecting the shoreline resources. They said that incorporating the critical area ordinance into the SMP is not only lawful, but it's actually considered and it's contemplated by the legislature when we have the division of what's protected by the CAO and what's protected by the shoreline. They held that it's not actually necessary for the county to show that new buffers are needed or necessary or that development is actually having harm to the shoreline. If whatever regulation is being adopted, if it matches or meets the substantial evidence in the record and satisfies Shoreline Management Act requirements, it's it's good enough. You don't have to go the extra step. It's nice to know, you know, how this new ordinance is going to be better than the old ordinance, but that's not required. It also said that it's not unlawful to prohibit certain uses in certain areas. You don't have to allow everything in every shoreline jurisdiction or shoreline designation. That pretty much covers that one. And then there's a few miscellaneous ones which we can go through pretty easily too. Sleeping tigers and went over in the city of Tukwila. And this was, I think the growth board got ahead of itself in invalidating what the city of Tukwila did with their designation of areas where essential public facilities can be sited because there's a lot of moratoriums and back and forth before this particular ordinance was adopted. But the ordinance specifically went through the city and said, okay, these are the zones where you can have essential public facilities. And Sleeping Tiger was a development or owner of a hotel that this new crisis diversion center was going to go into. And they challenged the ordinance, and the court said this actually allows all the essential public facilities where it wants it to go, doesn't allow them in others, and that's appropriate. But it just had some interesting facts before the actual adoption of the ordinance, I think the growth board got into, because it said the developer came to the city and said, I want to put it here. And they said, well, no, we're going to put a moratorium and we're going to figure out where we want them to go. And then the moratorium was lifted when the new zoning set forth where the essential public facilities. So at the time the developer came in, the essential public facility, the crisis diversion, could go into one place. And then after the moratorium was lifted, new zoning, it could only go in another place. So the developer couldn't use his property for that anymore. But he did challenge the moratorium. In Spokane, there's a public participation requirement issue. And this was where Spokane County, I think, got a little backwards. And they admitted it on the record, so it's kind of easy to evaluate. In 2009, they adopted population projections. And then they did an EIS, two EISs, to figure out the different sizes of their UGAs. And then they figured out what UGA they wanted. And at the last minute, they adjusted their population projection to fit in the UGA. And the attorney acknowledged that on the record. So the court said, that's backwards. You can't do that. Population projection is done at the beginning. And that is the foundation for all the other amendments. So, and the public participation piece fit in because they didn't tell anybody in any of the adoptions of the different UGAs that they were going to adjust the population. They'd already done it in 2009, and then in 2011, when they adopted their UGAs, they did the population. And so nobody knew that they were going to change it. Water rights, you probably have all heard of first at some level or not, or some level. I won't go too much into this because the overall impact of first has been, I don't want to say completely negated, but significantly reduced by the adoption of gross substitute Senate Bill 6091 earlier this year. And so Hearst had said counties need to, under GMA, need to protect their water quality and water quantity. And that means that the jurisdiction, cities and counties, need to review for legal adequacy of water when issuing permits for permit-exempt groundwater, or permits that rely on permit-exempt groundwater. There was a fix in the legislature earlier this year that kind of put a stop to that. And it's different for different jurisdictions, but in our jurisdiction, we're doing a water resource planning area with a bunch of other jurisdictions, and the deadline for this new watershed plan is June 30th, 2021. And meanwhile, we can go ahead and issue building permits with some caveats on that based in the statute. And we don't have to do anything to our comp plan or development regulations right now. So that's kind of on hold until 2021 when we figure out don't know numbers, but I know in Rye 15, which is us, there's Pierce County and Mason County, part of King County. I know Snohomish County has similar situation as us. I've been talking to their attorney.
So the expectation between now and 2021 would be that vacant parcels should be capable of getting well approvals?
I think the thought is that through this watershed analysis, we'll figure out what development, or if development does have an impact on these minimum in-stream flows, and whether the groundwater withdrawal from those are going to impact these stream flows. Another senior water.
So that planning process is described in the bill. It gives jurisdiction within the basis the opportunity to identify mitigation projects that will allow certain levels of development, continue mitigation storage,
year of well moratorium has kind of gone by the wayside.
No, and I'll give you an update on that's
actually. So the last two cases, this is more procedural issues, so it probably doesn't impact you guys much. But in another Spokane County case, the growth board found what the county had done for their planning in the UGA expansion was invalid. And that's more than just a non-compliance. That means it substantially interferes with the goals of GMA. And so when the growth board issues an order of invalidity, no development can vest to that anymore. It has to go back to whatever plan was last valid. And so in a mere non-compliance status, development can go forward while the county is working on a remand and fixing whatever. But an invalidity, essentially, whatever the county did was so bad that you can't have development on there. And in this case, Spokane County got an ordinance of order of invalidity because they expanded into the UGA into kind of an island area. And what they did to fix that was repeal their ordinance. And the growth board and the court eventually said mere repeal isn't good enough because you had development occurring. Invalidity only takes place after the board makes their decision and the county actually receives the decision. So between the time of enactment and the growth board decision, there can be development. And because of the invalidity, the county couldn't just undo its ordinance. It had to figure out whether that development that occurred during this time frame, which I think within a week or two of the enactment, there was development applications being submitted. The county need to go back and figure out how that either repeal or if you had done something else, how that action no longer substantially interferes with GMA goals. So that's, I guess, something more for the county as a whole to figure out. If we ever get an invalidity, we can't just say, oops, never mind. We actually have to do more work. A lot of it is in the eye of the growth board when they do an invalidity, but it's when it substantially interferes with, not just as non-compliant, but substantially interferes with the purpose of GMA and the goals. So it's a higher threshold, and there's some more details in there that a petitioner has to prove. So there's that. And Friends of White Salmon over in Klickitat County, this was just a mere non-compliance, but it's a lot less invalidity, and they repealed their ordinance, but there's also a SEPA appeal associated with the ordinance. And the parties actually argued that SEPA issue continued to go forward, but then the court said, you undid your ordinance, so that means the SEPA appeal also went by the wayside, because you can't have a SEPA appeal separate from an ordinance appeal. And last one, this one, unfortunately, is also unpublished, but it's important to consider that, you know, we have the docketing process. Each time we go through a comp plan amendment, we put things on the docket of what the county should consider. And in this case, the challenger said, well, you put things on the docket, and you took them off, and you put them back on. That's a consideration, so you couldn't make later changes to your comp plan, because GMA allows you to make comp plan changes once a year with certain exceptions. And the court said docketing doesn't actually mean considering. That's just the list of what things to consider. And the considering goes through when you consider them, put them on for adoption. So docketing doesn't affect later adoption of comp plan amendments. So it's pretty fast. I know there's other things. Correct. And this particular case addressed the kind of the once per year requirement that GMA has, because, and the reason they have this once per year is because they want everything to be considered all at once. So you don't have this piecemeal of doing one zoning change here and one here. You do it all at once. So I apologize, I don't have any of these slides printed out, but I can send them to you if you'd like.
Sure.
Really. So, sometimes you have to search.
What does that mean?
What?
Looks like we have Eric Baker next time.
Do you have electronic copies of what I'm handing out? But just in case, past planning commissions have liked it in both either or. And sometimes neither form, but thank you. The last couple times I've come before this board, for the record, my name is Eric Baker. I'm with the Kitsap County Commissioner's Office. I've been talking about our homelessness issues and predominantly code associated with transitory accommodations. The transitory accommodations are intended to be a stopgap housing choice, well, not choice, but a housing option for individuals who are suffering from short-term homelessness. These are not intended to be long-term facilities for people to live in for years on end. What they are intended to be is safe, secure places for people who are suffering from short-term homelessness to have a place that they can stay while they find other housing. Last year, we adopted a code, came through the Planning Commission, that allowed for transitory accommodations in urban areas. I won't go through all the various things that I went through at length with you a year ago. The main component here that these amendments address are twofold. One, previous transitory accommodations were only allowed in urban areas. So there was a lot of good reasons for them to be located in urban areas. We want them to be close to services, such as social services, employment services, transit, things of that nature. And then the other is the types of housing that these can be. We've talked about membrane shelters, largely tents. But also, there's been a lot of conversation about the wooden shelters. A lot of the local churches have been building them, putting them together, hopefully to come together into a community. But those are also safe, secure options and should be able to be considered in all the forms of transitory accommodations. Also, sometimes those can come in the form of metal shelters. Those also should be considered. I can go into the whole ins and outs of the transitory accommodation code that we looked at last year, or I could focus on the specific amendments, which is the shortest, smallest suite of amendments I think I've ever brought to anybody, ever. But I will say that the change from only allowing them in urban areas to now allowing them countywide, countywide being unincorporated countywide, is, while small in wording, it is impactful, and I'll go over the details as to why we're proceeding. But how many would like a larger primer on what transitory accommodations are and are not? I know it was just a year ago I was here, and I know it probably felt long at that point. So with that, I'll just focus on the two changes. Just for specific, your packet is a little larger. I wanted to make sure I provided the entire code for you so that you could look at it all in context. What I have is that the changes that you'll see are on pages 3, 4, and 5. All the rest is, again, just context. Yes, sir.
And just so we're clear, obviously the changes are struck out in red and the other ones are inputted in blue, so everything else is as presented. Is that right?
Everything that is changed is just in red.
Okay, blue. 2104. The numbers links were always blue. Okay.
Yeah. So. Okay. It's only red. So. Okay. New text underlined in red. Strikeout text struck out in red.
Okay.
So again, largely what you just see here in changes are on page 1, urban areas is struck out, and then in other places, the references to membrane shelter, because when we define shelters, we mean membrane, metal, wood. It's actually in the definition section. For some reason, when we made that change really late in the process last time, we did not strike out membrane from everywhere it needed to be struck out. So that being said, it wasn't discussed at any place, so it needs to be considered as a full change unto itself, not a map correction or text correction or anything like that. But I think backing up to the biggest is the move from urban to pretty much countywide. Over the course of the last year, a number of organizations have been looking to find locations for these transitory accommodations in our urban areas. We've looked at a series of public properties. We have looked at a number of church facilities and private property. One thing we're finding in this current market is that urban properties have a lot of desires beyond a transitory accommodation. A lot of these properties are selling very quickly for very high prices. Additionally, a lot of the properties we've been looking at are not located in unincorporated Kitsap County. While we have a certain amount of urban land in Silverdale and CK, the county, who's been interested in putting these on one of their facilities, owns a lot of land within certain cities. And we've been finding that the permitting process is not the same as you see here when you enter an incorporated city. That has created problems and significant expenses associated with the development of these sites. Things we tried to avoid in this code, and I still believe we did successfully avoid in many, many ways. But in certain conversations, we're running into very common constructs for permanent development, such as frontage improvements, full stormwater improvements, basically as if we were building a full structure that was going to be there forever and always. Those ramp up the costs quite severely. I think some of the things we've been seeing is that potentially we could be looking just to put 12 to 14 tiny homes on a property. We could be looking at $100,000 in upfront costs. That is not the intent of this code. And those issues, again, are associated with a particular city, but also is associated with the fact that we are talking about urban areas. Urban areas have substantially greater design standards, et cetera, which we all want them to meet. So what's been proposed is for us to allow these in rural areas as well. There's a multiple reasons beyond just the cost of land, the availability of land. It's the fact that a number of our large-scale churches are located in the rural areas. These places have shown interest in pursuing this, but they aren't allowed to have them at all. Additionally, a number of individuals in Kitsap County live in the rural areas. And when we're talking about the single-family transitory accommodation, that was the one that basically allows one RV, one shelter, wooden, metal, etc., on the property, generally meant for someone you know who is just down on their luck and they need a place to stay for a certain period of time. There's a number of folks who have been interested in doing that, and we've had to tell them, no, you're not allowed to do that because it's in the rural areas. Obviously, there's still some concerns about how will these folks receive services. I think as we know in Kitsap County, there is some additional transit in the urban areas, but transit is available in the rural areas and in certain circumstances, especially as it applies to homelessness and other vulnerable populations. So what we're proposing to do is we're proposing to open this up to the rural areas to allow these, again, temporary facilities to be located to deal with our homelessness issue. I think we are noting that our homelessness issue is not getting better, unfortunately. We are seeing a substantial displacement of individuals as housing becomes tighter and tighter, and mainly rents are going up much faster than wages. So we're not talking about people who've lost their jobs. We're talking about people who are gainfully employed, who had a place to live, and now do not have a place to live because of rent increases. So we are, again, looking at this as a way to address homelessness. This is not the silver bullet, magic bullet, one of the two. This is not the end-all be-all. This is a opportunity and a piece of the toolkit to be able to successfully provide people safe, secure places to stay while they seek other housing. I think anyone who's been walking in our public parks, they have noted that these folks are there. They are in these de facto encampments, again, not safe, not secure, not for them, not for the public. It is not the way that we want to see our homeless have to live. And these transitory accommodations, again, can provide a temporary stopgap opportunity for housing, but is not intended for people to live there for years on end. This is not affordable housing. This is not tiny villages. This is really transitory shelters intended to help those who are not being raised by the economic boom that this region is experiencing. Yes, sir?
You've used the word intended as a few times, but for the sake of it being code related, the definition then of temporary, as it speaks to any particular occupant and or the timeline of the parcel serving as such, are those defined?
The temporary nature is established by the duration of the permit. So the facility itself, these are intended to basically be six-month approvals with a six-month extension. Certain ones of these, if they go through the administrative conditional use permit process, can be longer term. They can become permanent. But again, that is not the expedited process I've described that's described in this code. That is the full land use, frontage improvement, stormwater. This is intended that you're going to have this here for forever. As for the temporary nature of the occupants in here, I'm going to have to comb back through. I don't believe we get into a level of specificity. As obviously, These are safer and more secure facilities, but they're not what we call palatial and type of things that people would like to stay in. But I don't believe there's any part of the code that specifically defines temporary residency, indicating that they can only be here for a month or 2 months or 4 months.
Yeah, and you know, the only reason I bring that up is it most likely falls to operations, right? That's a question that the church has to answer, for example. But I just think about whoever's the neighboring parcels on two or three sides of that church, you know, to what end is that answered on behalf of public safety?
And there are a series of conditions that are required for all of these facilities. There are codes of conduct. There's also a termination language in here that allows the Department of Community Development to terminate these. If code of conduct is not being followed, the conditions of approval are not being followed. This likely isn't going to be a one-time you're out type scenario, but we're talking about repeated lack of control of the site, and that is the responsibility of the host agency predominantly,
right,
but in conjunction with the sponsoring agencies such as Housing Solutions, the various employment agencies, mental health services.
And I'd assume at some level just RCWs regarding public nuisance or things to that effect, littering, et cetera, just it's all covered in,
yes,
in more the civil side of things.
Yes, they have, okay, to provide sanitary sewer service, porta potties, whatever, garbage services, et cetera. All these need to be to ensure the safety of not just the neighbors, but the people living in
the area. Yeah, thank you.
And that kind of came to mind for me too, as looking at the things that were considered in the code of conduct. Certainly, at least I know, not far from where I live, we have a lot of needles and such, drug-related paraphernalia, mm-hmm, constantly, not far from the Illahee Preserve. So if anybody's driven by there lately, it's really awful at the moment. The volunteers have been doing a pretty amazing job. But I'm noticing that the code of conduct, maybe you can't legislate this, but doesn't cover that. I could see in this portion of it, you know, the drug use or things like that, that so often, you know, I think what we see is maybe some very good, hardworking people end up in these sort of tent communities, and then you have the vagrant, not complying folks move in with the drug use, and it kind of pushes out a lot of those people who are just trying to survive. And I know it kind of is a little bit of a shell game like that. So I'm not seeing any of that covered here. And is there a legal reason why?
There's not a legal reason, but the purpose for the code is to allow the host agencies to determine exactly who they're going to allow into these facilities. They are still responsible, whether they are drug users or not, to follow the public nuisance laws, etc. We didn't want this code to be exclusionary. There are a number of people who are homeless right now who are suffering from substance abuse. Substance abuse is oftentimes self-medicating for mental illness. So we don't want the code to be leaving out a substantial amount of the homeless community that may need these services just as much as anyone else, though it would be a substantially greater lift for a host agency to ensure public nuisances aren't being met, et cetera, if they're allowing these types of things. But really, the code allows that to the discretion of the host agency and the sponsoring agencies that are responsible for overseeing the facility.
Is there anything that prohibits sort of the transaction of money involved in these things? Not necessarily rent, but you could draft it any or approach that any way, whether it's rural and saying you're going to be paying for electricity.
Okay, I'm sorry, I was back on the drug use. Transaction drug use. Okay. So please, can you start your question over again?
I was
looking someplace different.
Is there anything that prohibits a financial transaction? Not rent, not something that's maybe called rent, but fees and such that people would be not allowed to charge or allowed to charge?
There's nothing in the code that prohibits it. Oftentimes, a lot of that is in the form of sweat equity. These communities are required. Everybody has a job, generally, whether that is providing security, whether that is cooking, cleaning up, etc. Sometimes there are small fees to cover things. When I was talking about some of the upfront costs, that's not covering some of the long-term maintenance costs at times, which are going to need to be addressed, even if it is just porta potties and no electricity. There is nothing in the code that disqualifies you if you are requiring some level of transaction, though I will say a number of the sponsoring agencies are going to frown upon anything that is outside of standard best practices when it comes to housing, employment, mental health, or substance abuse related programs. So with any other questions? So I would hope to be able to bring this forward to the Planning Commission at your next available Planning Commission meeting. The presentation will be much shorter than this. There should be some folks coming from the Housing Solutions Center and the Homelessness Advocates. They were coming tonight. I turned them away as we didn't have a public hearing time for them to speak. But they also would be able to be here for deliberations. I am hoping to get this up and running and to make sure that we can open this up to some of the rural areas, move this as quickly as possible, and potentially, unless there's a substantial amount of written material or a substantial amount of public testimony that comes in at the next meeting, I may ask that we potentially move to deliberations afterwards. But again, that is up to the Planning Commission. I just want to put that out there as a request that we may end up making to help move this along to get some things up and running in the summer months, as obviously we hope to have things up and running for this winter season, and we're seeing a number of folks who are not able to find housing right now that really could benefit from one of these facilities. And I'm not pretending this is a short, quick endeavor to get one of these up and running.
Just curious, I assume obviously this is because of a need, and I shouldn't say need, but some pressure and people saying, you know, we need this outside. Do you have a feel for how many applicants may initially come forward when, assuming this gets passed?
The folks that have found difficulties locating the urban areas have noted potential sites located in the rural areas and some benefits potentially from that. There's probably three or four organizations that, again, are looking to put these up, as well as a endeavor from the Homes for All community, which is a combination of Coalition of Care, Kitsap County, and the county departments.
Okay, thank you.
Have you had any applicants? When we discussed this before, I think maybe there was something temporarily in place previously, but we didn't have any applicants. So have there been any applications under this?
We have no one who has come all the way through. We've had a number of people who have run into a series of obstacles along the way. Oftentimes it comes up with lease arrangements due to the price points, and at least one, there was moving towards application, and then someone came in with a very attractive offer to turn it into normal single-family market rate housing. So again, this economic boom has kind of semi-created the homelessness issue. It's also created some issues for resolving the homelessness issue, as, again, urban land is very limited in Kitsap County, and we want to ensure that it's going to, well, a lot of folks would like to ensure that it goes to the highest and best use, which unfortunately sometimes transitory accommodations is not viewed that way by property owners. I greatly appreciate your time tonight. Happy that Lisa didn't heat you up too much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lisa's going to remove her thumb drive while we get started. My name is Peter Best. I'm a planner in DCD. Briefly introduced to you about 6 months ago, but I am leading the effort on comprehensive planning, and so we're here to talk about the annual comprehensive plan amendment process for 2018. Are you seeing this on your screen in front of you, or only the big screen behind you? Okay. You can choose to come down if you'd like we did before, or I can also point where in your printed packet the material is that I'm also showing on these slides. So two slides just for folks who might be watching a recording here to understand kind of broadly comprehensive planning. We'll get through this quickly and move on to the substance of tonight. So Just briefly, comprehensive planning in Washington State is required and governed by the State Growth Management Act. It sets a common framework for comprehensive planning statewide. Additionally, at a regional level, we coordinate between counties and cities or across multiple counties through two processes that the Kitsap County is involved in. So we coordinate with Pierce, King, and Snohomish counties through the Puget Sound Regional Council and what are called multi-county planning policies, establish a common framework of high-level planning across those four counties and the cities within them. And then just within Kitsap County and the cities here, we have countywide planning policies that are required by GMA that further establish a common framework for how we're going to jointly plan across the county. Then each local jurisdiction, the cities and the county for unincorporated Kitsap, adopt comprehensive plans. These must be consistent with all of the policies and state law above on the slide. And then finally, the comprehensive planning is implemented through development regulations as well as programs. And regulations and programs need to be consistent with the comprehensive plan. So we last adopted an update to our comprehensive plan in 2016. And it's a 20-year vision for how our communities will grow, specifically how we're going to accommodate over 78,000 people. And generally, our plan is to accommodate almost 80% of those folks into our urban areas, both the cities and the urban growth areas. So the 20-year vision includes goals and policies as well as strategies around land use, economic development, how we're going to manage and protect the environment, housing and human services, part of what Eric was just talking about, transportation, capital facilities, sewers, water, transportation, and other facilities, parks, recreation, and open space, as well as we have sub-area and neighborhood plans within our comprehensive plan. So in addition to that vision, it contains strategies as well as expectations around the investments needed to achieve the vision, particularly in our capital facilities plan. Okay, so under GMA, we're required to do two types of review of our comprehensive plan. Every 8 years now, we're required to do a full review. And if that review identifies revisions that are needed, we need to make those. That was last completed in 2016, as I said. And then annually, we may choose at our discretion to conduct an annual review. And I'll get into a little bit more about that process here. But the board has to determine that a review is needed. They did that for this year. That scope of that annual review is established by resolution that's attached in your packet. And amendments during this annual review must be consistent with the existing comprehensive plan. So we're not looking at major changes to our comp plan, but enhancements, clarifications, and minor changes. And for folks who might be listening to this, this is a legislative process, so the board has full discretion around designing the scope of the process and in making a decision whether to adopt or not adopt any particular amendment. Lisa's presentation went into a couple aspects of that, and we'll come up to those things in a little bit more detail here. So our annual amendment process is covered in four phases. This slide is basically copying the last page in your packet of this, showing the schedule. So at the end of last year, we were going through our scoping process to determine what items would be included in the docket of amendments. We are currently in the development phase of the process where interest parties have submitted some site-specific applications for amendments or in redesignations of the property. And there's a number of county-sponsored amendments that are being developed currently. We'll move next into the analysis phase, where we'll do a CEQA review and prepare staff reports. And then we'll come to you in June for consideration. In July. So July, August, and September is when we anticipate being back before you with the substance of the amendments for public hearing and for recommendations and findings from the commission. And we'll conclude the year in October, November, and December with the board's consideration and final adoption in December. And as Lisa mentioned in her presentation, there is a 12-month window, essentially, for us to do this in without affecting the next year's amendment process. So we really need to fit this into, essentially, the calendar year to stay on our intended schedule. So the scoping process that we went through and has resulted in the resolution that's in your packet began with a catalog of various suggestions from staff and from interested parties. Those were presented to the board, reviewed by the board. Some of those were deferred to other years, and others were added to the docket. We held a public hearing, and the board adopted the resolution that's in your packet. We're calling that the initial docket. As we develop those items, the board will again consider all of those in March or early April, and they may adopt a final docket resolution. They're not required to, but if they choose to change the list of items being considered, they could adopt a final resolution. And as we spoke about briefly earlier, they may add items at that point in time before SEPA and the staff report cumulatively addresses all of the amendments together, or they could remove items before it goes into that further analysis phase. So there are six county-sponsored amendments currently under consideration. And summarized here, I'll briefly go over them. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer those. So the county has a non-motorized facilities plan. There's some minor updates to that that the advisory committee wants to make and the public works department wants to make. In addition, the Kingston community has developed a community trails plan that previously existed in subarea plans under previous comprehensive plans. That no longer has an official home under the comprehensive plan umbrella. So they're looking tonight, actually, at how to incorporate that into the non-motorized plan and get it back into the comprehensive plan umbrella. Another major undertaking we're doing this year is reviewing the urban village center zone, which exists in downtown Kingston. We're looking at the policies as well as the development regulations there. The intended purpose there is to identify potential regulatory barriers that we could address that unnecessarily restrict the intended development for downtown Kingston. We'll also be looking at some market factors or infrastructure factors, but those will be addressed through other processes if they're identified. The George's Corner Lammerd, one of these limited area of more intensive rural development that came up in Lisa's presentation as well. We are looking at a minor boundary adjustment there, and this is up at the intersection of Highway 104 and Hansville Road. And as a minor boundary adjustment, our goal here is to achieve no change in the overall area of the Lammerd. Essentially, there's some facts specific to this situation that we think allows for consideration of the boundary adjustment. And Lisa had mentioned there are some pretty tight restrictions around changing these boundaries. And so we think that there's a case here to be made for consideration, and we'll develop that and then against the criteria in state law and see where that goes. The resolution in your packet has an attachment with a map showing the area of the boundary that we're looking to adjust. Another amendment here is just housekeeping, essentially, around public facility designations and park classifications. So essentially updating our zoning and land use designation maps to catch up with acquisitions and dispositions of property. Additionally, the Parks, Recreation, and Open Space Plan, which is adopted by reference into the comp plan, it's currently under revision now. So it's likely to be adopted by resolution this spring. And so this is adopting that formally into the comp plan. And then finally, there's a review of affordable housing policies as well.
Peter, quick question, yes. If you don't mind. With regard to the Lamrud map at George's Corner, a portion, if not all of that, was a site-specific review last year, if I'm not mistaken.
A portion of it was. So the parcel,
the south side of Rite Aid, so to speak.
Right. So when the Lamrud boundary was drawn, that southeast corner of the intersection was all one parcel. Following Lamrud boundary, it was short-platted into four parcels. And those parcel boundaries were one of the factors being considered here is that those parcel boundaries were driven in large part by critical areas and critical area buffers. So a more specific site analysis than was done with the Lamrud boundary establishment. So the parcel, the fourth parcel that's mostly to the south of the Lamrud, was a site-specific amendment in 2016, which was not approved. And so what we're looking at proposing here is there's a portion of that property that is covered by the Lamrud, essentially withdrawing the boundary north to the parcel line above the Lamrud boundary. And then the parcel on the very southeast corner of the Lamrud area, which is now split zoned into three zones, adjusting the Lamrud boundary around that parcel. And there's essentially an area for area exchange with the withdrawal and the partial expansion there.
Continuing on with the local area of more intense rural development, I remember when this was first brought before the Planning Commission, and the concern was at the time that most of that area really did not qualify under the GMA at that time, that only the George's Corner gas station was the development that was developed pre-1990. In addition to that, there are several areas in Kitsap County that would qualify for that designation that have never been considered. It's just a point that we are talking about a alteration of something that was a little bit shaky to start with and continues to be so. It's any reflections on that from Lisa, she'd be interested or not. We'll put you on the hook.
The staff report will
be included.
History and use the, by law, we're required to use the same criteria in evaluating this boundary adjustment. So you'll get a full staff report looking at that. Thank you. So moving on, the other aspect of this are site-specific applications. Looking back at the county's practice, most years site-specific applications are not allowed. 2016 and the major update, there was a large number of site-specific amendments requested, but typically in an off year like this, they're not allowed. So this is a bit of a new thing. There are three categories or areas of consideration for applications. In the rural areas, we allowed applications to add mineral resource overlay designations to properties, as well as to add forest resource land designations. And moving forward, we intend to have these as kind of annual features for comprehensive plan amendment cycles. And in urban growth areas, we allowed applications to redesignate property for infill and redevelopment. You're aware that the board recently completed adopting a resolution that kind of finished off the Transfer Development Right, or TDR, program for the county. And so now acquisition of transferable development rights are required for certain applications in urban growth areas. And in In this batch of five applications, there are two that are required to acquire TDRs for a total of 13 TDRs across the two applications. So there are five applications. Two of these are, and these are covered in more detail in attachment 5 of your packet. This is a bit cryptic with the acronyms up here, but there are two that are in rural areas that are for mineral resource overlay designation. Two of these are changing from a residential designation to a commercial designation. One in the Central Kitsap UGA, and one in the Port Orchard UGA. And then there is one in the Silverdale UGA that's almost 110 acres to redesignate what is currently industrial and mineral resource land to residential, urban low residential. So that's a very sizable one, and we'll be looking at that carefully. So those are the five applications that came in this year. So that's what we're working on right now. We have an online open house, a web page that we keep updated fairly regularly. It provides an archive for anyone coming into the process late to catch up. You can go and see what current status and what opportunities for participation are currently, as well as anticipate what next steps are through December. We have a team of folks working on this, which is a wonderful team. I'm really happy to be with them. And we're here to support you in your process. And if there's any questions you have between now and July, we're happy to engage with you on what will be coming your way.
Thank you. Dave Ward.
How nice it is to have a full agenda, isn't it? Much better than driving all the way here and having only one thing. The issue that I'm going to address right now is the code update ad hoc advisory committee. I do not have slides, so you don't need to do an owl impression and spin your head around to see the screen. Just as a reminder, back last fall, we talked with the commission about some of the, in the spirit of looking forward as to where the department is going with some of its code development and comp plan processes, and we talked about increasing transparency and predictability, and we've taken some steps to make that happen. We talked about getting onto a regular schedule of code updates and comp plan. Thank you. Oh, he's already out the door. All the things that the schedule that you saw Peter present represents our attempt to try to get our comp plan updates back on track in terms of scheduling and predictability. So the next step in this process is to start whittling away at this list of about 200 to 300 code update ideas that we have that we've described to you before. Over the past several years, the department has accumulated a laundry list of, I'm going to call them ideas because it's for lack of a better word. They're not necessarily proposals at this point, but they're ideas for changes in the code. Many of these have come at the suggestion or request of project applicants. Some of them have come up through the course of reviewing permit applications. Ways that we can streamline processes, inconsistencies in the code, things of that nature. They range from small projects to multi-year planning efforts, and there's every shade of gray in between. Some of them are very clean and quick and can be probably changed very, very easily and readily. Others will take a lot of analysis, and you know, most of them have not been baked at all. At this point, they are all ideas. So, this list of code update ideas is on our website, so any of you can download this. It's a growing list. Since we've spoken with you about it last fall, there have been more things that have been added to this list, so the growth has not stopped. And in fact, part of our openness and transparency initiative is to open this up, and we created a form so that way anyone can get online, fill out our form, and actually make a new suggestion and have it added directly into our spreadsheet that contains all these code ideas. So this is a pretty open process at this point. Recognizing that the list is there and that it's growing and that things are moving along and we need to be able to schedule an evaluation of these and get staff working on how do we process all these things, we are pulling together an ad hoc committee right now this is a temporary committee that's designed to develop criteria by which we can then evaluate which of these code ideas will move forward, which of them we can say we considered, cross them off the list, and which ones we can push to the back burner for future consideration. Our idea on this is that this ad hoc committee would come together over the next couple of months, would develop the criteria by which we evaluate these ideas and prioritize these ideas, and then take that long list and run it through those criteria for a first shot at trying to prioritize which ones we're going to pick up next. After that, we will wait and see what happens in terms of the way the committee works and see if everything seems to be functioning smoothly, do a little adaptive management along the way, and looking towards the future, reformulate the committee so that way in subsequent years, usually in January of the of any given year or the December of the preceding year, a committee would then take those criteria and evaluate any new items that come up on the list. So it's not a big haul every year. Hopefully that would be a smaller job picking up those new items every year. So the schedule for the committee is in your packet. It's on attachment A of your packet, which should be page 2. We are trying to get the committee pulled together within the first half of March. We've already identified some members from the Department of Advisory Group, from the tribes. We've had commitment from Kitsap Building Association to furnish a couple of committee members. And then most of the work would happen through April and May, and then hopefully we would have that list processed in May, which we could then look at as a department, take that prioritized list, go to the board, and then talk with the board about where our priorities fall. But this process would then help us, number one, develop the process by which we're going to do it in every subsequent year, and number two, get that first prioritization done. So that way we will know where we want to go for our 2019 agenda of work. So the request of the commission tonight is I would like to invite two commission members to sit on this committee and participate in this initial process. And Tom Nevins has already volunteered to fill one of those slots. And if there are any other members who are interested, I would love to get your information and get you in the loop for this process. And if there are three, we can do rock, paper, scissors, or whatever other process the chair decides.
Do you have any level of expectation as far as total hours of involvement?
This is a best faith effort at guessing at what it will take. We think we can do it in 4 or 5 meetings of a couple of hours apiece. We expect that they would be weekday meetings that once we get all the committee members together, we can try to schedule a time that works for everybody. But we're guessing about 4 to 5 meetings, probably let's err on the side of 5 and figure 2 hours apiece for each of those meetings.
I'm willing to have that conversation with you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Do we need to do rock, paper, scissors?
Maybe. No? I could do it. Yeah, throw the other retired guy in the mix, would you?
Okay, does the chair have a preference on how to narrow it down to 2?
I don't. I didn't know from Aaron, it kind of seemed like you were wanting to get more information.
Yeah, just speaking of as somebody who's about to go into coaching baseball and having 4 kids at home. So that's why I'm joking about Joe being retired. I mean, it serves my purpose to be interested in it as a professional, regardless. But, you know, as far as total time available, I'm willing to concede it at this point to the retired gentleman that sit on the dais.
Do you have more time? Are you good, Joe, now that you're retired?
I'm good.
You're on every committee possible. I think we're just going to...
No, not yet. But this one, yes.
Okay.
That sounds great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And then next up, we did have Louisa. I understand she is ill, so Mr. Bolger.
So for the record, Jim Bolger, Assistant Director, Department of Community Development. Louisa apologizes for not being able to come. With regards to that last item, I'm surprised Commissioner Baglio didn't sign up because then he could have gotten potentially three votes for KBA for other member tasks. Seriously, Louisa wanted to do a couple of updates, and I have a couple of just kind of for the good of the order pieces of information I wanted to add during this time. One of the things we wanted to make you aware of was that the department's going to be coming forward with some new formats for the materials that we provide you. There's been real interest within the department to really kind of standardize our staff reports to both the hearing examiner, the Board of County Commissioners, issuance of administrative decisions. And so we have kind of a subcommittee within the department that's really looking at all of these different formats. Right now, we provide you an executive summary that usually has a lot of kind of staff report information embedded in it. What we're moving towards is just having that be a very brief, high-level summary of the agenda item, not have a lot of the staff analysis in it, and then have kind of a standalone staff report that becomes more transportable as we take things through our legislative process to the board with more thorough analyses. We're also looking at standardizing them so you don't get a you basically will have a consistent staff report, whether it's, you know, Liz Williams or Peter or Darren developing it. We'll hit on the same types of information in all of those. So before we go live, we'll be getting you guys a chance to look at those to make sure that you're still getting the information that's important for you to make decisions. Similarly, because the hearing examiner is a judicial process, a little different type of information, permit-related information that goes before them. So we're also looking at how we can standardize those across staff so that they're consistent and that there's, you do get, periodically, you will get some of the current planning, like open space applications coming before you. So they'll be looking similar to the staff reports that you get on some of the more long-range kinds of activities. So that's one thing that you should be looking for in the next couple of months and that we'll be introducing to you. Also, in terms of the findings of fact, we're looking at trying to figure out a way to schedule our meetings and arrange them so that those aren't necessarily left hanging, so that that becomes the only agenda item for a subsequent meeting. So one of the things we're looking at is if it looks like it's one of those issues that we think you'll be able to get through your deliberation and decision, if we schedule those earlier in the meeting, then that can give staff time, a chance to run down, prepare findings of fact, and introduce those later on in the meeting rather than have to call you back in. As was asked earlier by one of your members, is there a legal time frame in which those findings of fact have to be adopted? There isn't, but those findings of fact are important information on the department or on the commission's deliberation that we present to the board as these things go from the Planning Commission recommendation to the board adoption consideration. So we would want to have that set up so we can deal with those right away, having a printer available to us and making sure that we have time to get those things drafted. So you might consider
one thing that might add to the findings in fact is that I noticed at the last Board of County Commissioner meeting, the commissioners asked specific questions relating to, you know, the Planning Commission's decision and what was the deviation from the majority. And so I'm wondering if a little, if inclusion of that might be instructive for the commissioners, something you put in the findings of fact, where are the points of disagreement?
Sure. That's a good suggestion.
The other issue that I wanted to bring up that Louisa, I took back to Louisa following an earlier Planning Commission meeting, I think it was back in December, might have been late November, where there was a question asked about the Department Advisory Group, oftentimes called the DAG. And I said I would come back with more information on that, or the department would. So I wanted to take this opportunity to kind of fill you in. And one of the things that we've included in the agenda in your packets and up on the screen here is really the purpose statement for the advisory group. The department advisory group really kind of came about following a 360-degree evaluation of the Department of Community Development that the Board of County Commissioners commissioned back in 2006. It's oftentimes called the Jones and Bauer Report, or is it the Bauer and Jones Report? I'm not sure. But basically, this report came out, and it really looked at a series of recommendations for the department's consideration. Top among them was really to kind of get back to more of a customer focus and to look at our processes from our customers' viewpoint. And so it recommended the establishment of this department advisory group that was really to provide information and advice to the department on its business processes. So primarily, permit review, how can we improve processes there? It really wasn't looking at the policy level work that is a major line that you deal with in the Planning Commission. So they really kind of came together. I think they started to meet in 2008. It was specifically identified to go out there and look at some of our frequent flyers for the department on the permitting side of things. It's been meeting regularly since 2008. On the last Tuesday of every month. I don't remember because I picked this up from Louisa just this afternoon. I think the membership right now is about 20 people overall, but I think the regular participation is about 10. The group was instrumental in helping the department really kind of move towards its lean processing of its permitting procedures and realizing kind of the improvements that we saw there. It also coincided with the department's permitting operations being funded through a special revenue fund, which basically means it's a self-sustaining operation. So that group has been important in terms of establishing policies related to fees and those kinds of things. More recently, with the change in leadership within the department, that group has kind of been looked at again, and they've had a lot of conversation in 2017 about what should be the purpose, the ongoing purpose of this group. There was a discussion as to whether maybe it should branch out, whether it should be looking more broadly at the lines of business within the department. The decision was made that no, perhaps not, that they should really kind of focus on the side of business in terms of the permitting operations for the department. Included in your packet is the purpose statement to advise department leadership on policy, code amendment, and operational issues related to processing, issuing, and finalizing of building permits, land use applications, and inspections. We do use that group, the department uses that group as another venue for outreach because of the networks that these folks belong to. So oftentimes we do give informational updates to members of the DAG in terms of what's going on from the process status of the critical area ordinance update is one example. I think the presentation that Dave did about our moving towards more of a kind of institutional formula for doing our code updates, that was taken to the DAG, and we'll be soliciting membership, as you saw, on that group. So it really is focused on our business practices within the department. It's not a group that we're seeking recommendations on policy and code development and those kind of materials, which are before you here as the Planning Commission. So is there any other information I can or questions I can answer related to the advisory group? Full disclosure, Commissioner Baglio is a member of the advisory group. And there was in part of our discussions in 2017 about the purpose and the standing of the group relative to the department, there was some consideration of making it similar to, we have like these community councils and other groups that are actually convened or approved or sanctioned by the Board of County Commissioners. The Department Advisory Group has not gone through that process. We don't have a specific terms that I'm aware of. It's really a kind of a advisory group, not ad hoc, in that we have kind of a standing membership, but it doesn't have the formal status of one of the other major committees that the county convenes. Okay. So I also wanted to follow up. These are not on the agenda, but I wanted to give you some information on them. One is the result of the Hearst decision and the recent legislation that you heard about in Gross Senate, Substitute Senate Bill 6091, now called the Watershed Restoration Act. This was signed into law on January 19th, and it was done under an emergency, and so it went into effect immediately. There were some provisions there that relate to our water resource inventory area that we're in. We're in Water Resource Inventory Area 15, which encompasses all of the Kitsap Peninsula, including portions of Mason and Pierce County, as well as Vashon Island, which is King County. So we get to bring the whole party to this. Everybody's invited to this party. There are a number of requirements associated with that act. Two of them are before the board, or will be going before the board on Monday, the 26th, for public hearing. And that is, there's a requirement that limits the amount of water that any one connection can be drawing on one of these water right permit exempt wells. If that well has been approved subsequent to the effective date of the act. So that water limitation currently set by statute is 950 gallons a day, average gallons a day per year. So that means you can go up to 1,000 one day, but you're probably gonna be below 950. We've instituted that into our building code now, so it's under kind of the complete application sections before the board. There's also a $500 fee now that is added to building permits who are going to be hooking up to these post January 19th permit exempt wells. The wells themselves aren't affected. They still have a volume of 5,000 gallons a day, so they can accommodate a number of connections to them. But that $500 will also be a new permit associated with building permits. So we're making changes in code where that's identified in Title 14. It's also being updated through a resolution for which there'll be a public hearing on Monday as well in the DCD fee policies. That $500 doesn't stay within the department. $350 of each permit gets remitted back to the Department of Ecology, and the department or the county can keep $150 from each of those permits. We don't know specifically yet, as Department of Ecology is kind of the lead state agency for implementing this. We don't know whether there will be any constraints on that $150. I mean, is that to pay for our participation in planning? Does that have a special purpose to it that hasn't been defined in the act, that wasn't defined in the act itself? So we're waiting to see what happens there. Yes, sir.
So you said it's another permit? I guess I was curious. Is that
it's another fee on top of an existing permit?
Oh, so it is not an actual, it's just a fee you pay, but there's no additional permit that's going to be issued associated with that?
It'll be for the building permit. It'll be part of the regular fees on top of the regular fees associated with a building permit if you're connecting to one of these post-January 19th permit exempt wells.
Okay.
So it's not retroactive if you're on a permit exempt well. And say you want to come in with a new house and you're going to hook up to an existing permit exempt well, and that well's been there for before January 19th, you don't have to pay that fee. The other requirement that's going into code is that these conditions will be recorded to the title of the property for which these connections are being made. So you'll have to record that 950 gallons per day average usage. There's also a stipulation in the act that says in the declaration of a drought emergency by the state, if it covers this area, you're further reduced to 350 gallons a day, and that water usage is limited to indoor use only, with some exceptions for fire break and fire buffer areas to keep those greened up. So that's those all are going to get recorded to title.
Just as a layman homeowner who's never been on a septic system, ballpark for me, you know, who uses 950 gallons a day? Is it a four-bedroom, 2,400-square-foot house fully occupied year-round?
Wait till your four kids are teenagers.
I've got four kids, two teenagers. We're getting there.
No, I think the health district, the average household usage is in the neighborhood of 350 to 400. I think that's what.
So you got to be watering the lawn and washing the cars. And
Yeah, you'd have to probably work pretty hard.
No, I know where the shutoff is for the 13-year-old.
There you go.
Well, and the thing that's a little odd, good, bad, or indifferent, these are not, they're not going to be metered. So even though that is the value, there's nothing that actually meters the flow of water.
There's no metering for the jurisdictions right now. Department of Ecology is authorized to establish some pilot projects that look at metering. There are also some of these water resource inventory areas in the state that do already, as part of their watershed planning that was done earlier in the last decade. They actually do have metering on permit exempt wells. So, right, there's no metering requirement right now, but this act is looking out into the future, and I think if these pilot projects that they initiate show that there's value to that, then that may be the case. The other element that's going to affect us here in Kitsap is the planning requirement that was alluded to during Lisa's presentation. The Department of Ecology is to convene a water restoration enhancement committee, which is looking at putting together kind of a water resource management plan for the peninsula. And they'll have some discretion in identifying projects that will go forward. There is a prescriptive list of participants for those committees. All of the jurisdictions within those areas are part of it. Tribes, both those with reservation lands within those watersheds, as well as those with usual and accustomed areas, are also to be included. And then representation from stakeholders, supposed to be one home building industry representative. There's supposed to be a representative from agriculture present. There's supposed to be representatives from the environmental community that are on those committees. We don't know yet what Ecology's process is going to be for vetting those members, given that we have four counties participating. You know, we have the greatest land mass, but we don't know if it's the building associations in all four counties are going to vie for that one seat on the committee. There's also some interesting adoption elements to it, and that is that if this Restoration Enhancement Committee can't come to an approved plan, that the plan then will be taken by Ecology. It will be moved to the Salmon Recovery Funding Board, who has technical review capabilities. A lot of our in-stream flows are based on fish. They'll make recommendations to the Department of Ecology for improving the water quantity issues and water management within the Kitsap area. And then the Department of Ecology will work from those recommendations and essentially approve a plan for RIA 15. So unlike previous watershed planning efforts, there will be an approved plan at the end of this. And I've been asked if this will allow us to modify our in-stream flow rules for the peninsula. And at this point, Ecology is only considering these committees, aside from projects like mitigation in certain basins, to allow for future development. They're really only looking at modifications to our in-stream flow rules to be in the neighborhood of fees we may want to charge to finance some of these projects that may be identified, or in the actual volume of water that can be used. So do we go from 950 up to 3,000 like some other watersheds are doing, or do we drop down to 500 because we don't have enough to sustain 950 per connection going into the future? So there's still a lot of things that are developing along these lines, but we'll keep you apprised as we go.
Can you send us a URL link to show us where Area 15's boundary is?
Sure can.
Thank you.
The other thing I wanted to mention was some of you may have heard of a Ruckelshaus Center. This is a this is a joint University of Washington WSU center that was set up to really kind of look at issues that are of significance within the state. They serve as kind of a convener, mediator, facilitator. They have been working on a project really looking at the effect of growth management now that it's been on the books for a couple of decades, and the legislature funded them to move on to developing kind of a hit list of how we could be improving the Growth Management Act. Are there things that are working well? Are there things that aren't working so well and can be improved upon? And so they're entering phase two of their work, and they're having a workshop. They're having a number of workshops around the state. And they're having one here in Kitsap County on March 27th from 12:30 to 4:30 at the Norm Dix Center. There will be another session that they'll have just for elected officials within this area, but this is more for a broader audience. And planning commissions and staff have been identified as kind of the appropriate audiences for these to really come in and identify our feelings about how growth management has worked or has not worked. If you go to the site here, it's hyperlinked, and we'll send you out a link to this as well. But you can go to that, and you can see the series of discussion questions that they'll be walking people through as they're gathering some of their information on terms of kind of developing the scope for phase two. So I just wanted to bring this to your attention. I think it would probably be a really great idea to go. In many respects, Kitsap has gone through its share of growing pains, probably in the 90s. Lisa's presentation would have had Kitsap and our accompanying jurisdictions identified more and more than we do today, thankfully. But this may be an opportunity to help kind of contribute to the improvement of the Growth Management Act. I'll leave that up there. So the last thing I wanted to bring to your attention, we do have a requirement to, and I think I may have mentioned this before, to produce a annual report to the Board of County Commissioners. So hopefully at your March 6th meeting, we'll have a draft of that. It should go out in your materials, which will basically be a retrospective look at 2017 and report out to the board in terms of the activities that you undertook. We'll develop that at a staff level, that draft, and then consider that at your next meeting, hopefully for approval by the commission to send on to the board. Typically, once that's sent to the board, that usually creates the initiative to schedule a meeting for the Planning Commission and a joint meeting of the Planning Commission and the Board of County Commissioners. So that will hopefully be something that we can get scheduled for March as well. That's all I got.
So just an FYI, I checked, I had forgotten. When you design a septic system, they design it 120 gallons per day per bedroom for a septic system. So as a comparison.
Okay.
Right. Thank you. Is there anything else for the good of the order? Okay. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
Is there an explanation of why the screen doesn't work?
The projector.
Right.
Broke, and apparently we haven't been paying our Best Buy credit card, so we can't run out and get another one. I don't know. I'm kidding, for the record. It's been down for what? Almost
a month. It's been a while.
Can we make a motion?
You can.
Can we? Okay.
So I can tell you that I went to a meeting. They held a meeting, and IS is working on redesigning everything, all the technology in here. And so we were all very excited, but it's going to be kind of a long process. And so in the meantime, some of the next steps are figuring out what we can do in between. We could do that. It wouldn't give you, from the distance, it wouldn't be very big, but we could do that too if it would help.
For us on this end, it would be fine.
Yeah.
You guys.
Yeah, I can look into doing that. I don't know if that would be helpful or not. I can try that.
Luck.
Or even a better suggestion, we have screens in front of us. Make those work.
We attempted that today. We were hoping that would work, but only two screens work, so we could draw a lottery. So we're working on it. I know it's kind of difficult, but we'll see what we can figure out.
State of affairs at the county.
Anything else for the good of the order?
We have a motion to adjourn.
We need to do that. So moved.
I don't know. I have other meetings where we have to. So.
Oh.
We don't need a motion. We'll just adjourn now at 7:30.